Act 1. Susan. Last summer, reporter and radio producer Sandy Tolan was going to do a story about the sex industry from the workers' perspective with a woman named Susan Walsh. Walsh was an aspiring writer who worked in go-go bars in New Jersey to support her son. And then, a week or so before they were going to start work on their documentary, Susan Walsh disappeared. On July 16th, she left her home in Nutley, New Jersey, to make a call at a payphone on the corner. She didn't have a phone at home. She left her wallet, her keys, and her beeper behind. She told her son that she would be right back, and she never came back. Everybody close to her assumes that she's dead. So Sandy Tolan decided to set out on a different story to try to understand what her life was like in the go-go bars of Jersey and to understand what might have led to her life coming apart. Again, a warning to parents, this is another story about the sex industry. Large sections of it may not be suitable for younger listeners.
My first stop is at the Village Voice, where my old friend James Ridgway works as a political correspondent. Jim had suggested Susan Walsh and I work together. She was the researcher for his new book, Red Light, Inside the Sex Industry, which tells the story from the point of view of the workers, strippers, streetwalkers, call girls, and porn actors.
I first met Susan Walsh in the offices of Screw Magazine when I was working on a book about the sex industry, and I went to see Al Goldstein, who was the editor. And as I was talking to him, I was complaining about how I couldn't get anywhere in this whole business and asking if he could give me some advice. And he said, well, you know, there's this woman that comes in here every so often, and she writes for us, and she'd be really good because she really knows this stuff. And at that point, for some reason, you know, this woman suddenly appeared, and she had this kind of like long blonde hair, was kind of flying in the wind, and she had this motorcycle jacket, and she's real skinny and awkward looking. She hardly looked like somebody you'd think was a striptease dancer or go-go dancer. She looked like kind of a college kid, only as I later learned, you know, that Susan was in her 30s.
A single mother trying to break into journalism, paying the bills by dancing Jersey go-go. Susan started working with Jim 2-3 days a week.
And she was very smart. She certainly knew the sex business like nobody I ever met when I was doing this book, and I certainly met quite a few people. She knew all aspects of it, and what she didn't know, she'd find out. She was like a really good reporter, and she was a terrifically good mother. The big thing in her life was her kid, her son David, who at that time was, you know, 10, 11. You know, he would come to my office, and he'd work on the computer, or he'd work his homework while she did her work on the telephone, or we talked. And she was just totally devoted to this boy.
Susan longed to be a full-time writer. Jim got her to write a few pieces on go-go for The Voice. He set her up with a couple of film and radio gigs. But dancing paid the bills. She'd work 6 days a week sometimes, 2 shifts a day, just barely making it.
And she was always toting this bag around with her, with her G-string and her heels. And she would just, you know, if she didn't have the money to get on the PATH train to go home, she would just check into one of these clubs and dance a set and see if she'd come out with $10. Now, it's not exactly the high life here.
At dusk, I head through the Lincoln Tunnel to the Jersey Turnpike, past the big white oil storage tanks and the rusted globes of natural gas. I'm riding with Jill Morley, a writer and actress who worked in Jersey Go-Go till a couple of years ago when she got sick of it and left. Jill was a friend of Susan's.
It's terribly sad. I go in and out of being emotional about it because sometimes it just seems like it's too absurd to be true that it's happened. It just feels such a loss.
Jersey is the land of go-go, 350 clubs by one estimate, the most of any state. We pull off the turnpike and head into the small town of Belleville, just outside Newark. We're trying to find an old haunt of Susan's. And there it is, right on the well-lit main drag. Wiggles, says the pink sign, and below that, a banner. Breakfast special, legs and eggs, Friday, 7 a.m. to noon.
This seems more like a place Susan would work. It's more like diving and, like more regular-looking women working, you know, very Jersey-looking.
On the narrow linoleum bar at Wiggles, a woman walks the gauntlet between the hands of men and the bottles of whiskey, gyrating in a spandex bikini. She pivots toward the men, pauses, presses her breasts together. customer lodges a folded-up dollar bill in her cleavage. At the bar, we ask around, but nobody seems to remember much about Susan Walsh.
Can I ask you something? We're friends of Susan Walsh.
What?
Of Susan Walsh.
But then a dancer tells us, oh yeah, she remembers Susan. She takes Jill backstage to the dressing room where it's quieter.
Oh, I met her. She was very nice. She was really, really nice, but I thought she was like a little bit ditzy. And when I found out when she was missing, and I found out, and I read the article in the New York Times, or, no, the New York Post, and it said that she was working on a documentary and all this stuff, I was thinking, she didn't seem, it's terrible, she didn't seem that smart to me. Not that she wasn't smart, but she seemed a little ditzy, and she didn't seem that mature. Then I found she was 36, and I was surprised. I thought she looked really nice because she was, like when I first seen her, I thought she was very striking because she was so pale-skinned and her hair was so white without looking phony. You know, most girls with white hair, it just looks, you know, it's bleached, it looks phony. It looked very natural on her, whether it was real or not, I don't know. And I haven't heard anything. Somebody told me that her family is pretty much, thinks that she must be dead because she hasn't popped up yet and she would never leave her son. And they were saying maybe they should put it on Unsolved Mysteries. Maybe we'd find her then.
They are, they're doing it.
Are they going to? Yeah. When is it going to be on?
February 14th, I think it's supposed to air.
Wow, that would be great. Maybe something will come of it.
Yeah.
And so it goes throughout the evening. Jill and I walk into a go-go bar. Jill goes backstage. A dancer speculates on what might have happened to Susan. Maybe it was the Russian mob. Maybe it was the regular mob. Maybe it was a deranged go-go patron. Maybe somebody was mad at something she said in the book Red Light.
It could have been anything. It could have been anything.
You think she could have been bumped off, maybe?
Who knows? But usually there have been quite a few dancers that have been found in different areas.
Really?
Of course. Yeah, you hear about it in the entertainment magazine or in the newspaper, you know. It's never played up, but, you know, because everybody thinks, you know, a go-go dancer, oh,
right.
She must be a slut or whatever, but, you know, there's still people too, and whatever they do, but nobody deserves to be killed.
Right.
Here at the Marylebone, a dancer speaks in sharp, low tones, warning us not to ask too many questions about what happened to Susan. Here at Club After Dark, dozens of Russian women, part of the new wave of immigrant labor, grind themselves into the laps of the men at the bar. Here at Club 516, smoke and spandex and dead eyes, a woman mechanically pulling her skirt up and down as she stares at herself in the mirror. I'm reminded of a photograph of Susan in the book Red Light. She's on a carpeted stage, guys with beards are perched on bar stools enjoying a laugh. And Susan, in a bikini, blonde hair falling over her shoulders, swivels her backside toward the men. She's poised before the mirror, dazed, alone, in another world. Susan used to say that when she first got into go-go, it seemed like such a good idea. Here she is telling her story on a radio talk show 2 weeks before she disappeared.
I had been working for 6 years as a writer for engineering and business publications after college and raising a son pretty much on my own. I was separated and I'd lost my job because of the recession. And I said, wow, how can I raise my son, go to graduate school, and take my writing out of the trade sector into the public sector and still do it all and not, you know, not just have time to make dinner and go to sleep every night. And I thought it was an easy way out. Because I had a friend who was making thousands a week. She said to me, why don't you dance a couple nights a week and then you can do whatever you want. Raise your kid, go to school. I said, great. At first I felt totally in control. Lots of attention. Men love me. I'm getting attention. I'm the little princess on stage. It's insidious. And after a while, I realized that it was exhausting. There were many hidden costs. And I stayed in it for far too many years. And I'm not happy with the fact that I am still dancing. Yes, I did complete half of my master's, and I have been doing a lot of writing. But boy, what a high price I had to pay.
At lunchtime on the last day of July, I drive out to see Susan's mom, Martha Young, in Wayne, New Jersey. Susan's son, David, is visiting that day. Susan's been missing for 2 weeks now. We eat lunch and make small talk. Then they invite me to join them at a video arcade at the mall.
Well, what do you want to do, man? Should we get the tickets first?
Oh, Lucky and Wild, that's a great two-player game.
How do I get
Martha watches David run off, dashing between video games. She's glad he's got something else to do besides think about his mother. She says he's blocking his feelings, not wanting to confront the possibilities.
And I hope Susie is still alive, but it's the not knowing that is so horrible. But it's also what would be worse is knowing that she isn't with us anymore. And I'm just crazy inside. I feel as though I'm broken apart.
This is all so unlike Susan, her mom says. She would never leave David like this. Then Martha pauses a moment. She has something she wants to say. She stares at my microphone.
Hi, Susie. This is Mom. If you're listening or if you hear about this, I want to give a message to you. I love you very, very much, more than anybody in the world. And I just want to see you again. And please take good care of yourself wherever you are and know that you're loved and missed so much by everybody. I love you.
Late October, 3.5 months now since Susan disappeared. Jill Morley and I are in Midtown Manhattan. We're paying a visit on Susan's therapist, Mary Nolan, who works a lot with go-go girls and prostitutes. We're trying to make sense of something. By all accounts, Susan had a lot going for her outside of go-go, and she wasn't making much money dancing, yet she kept doing it.
Susan could not cut the ties with that world because it was a powerful pull for her. So something was happening. I guess the term would be repetition compulsion. It's acting out some type of an early event to get it right in the future. And she worked the whole gamut of the adult sex industry. I don't think she missed a wrinkle because she had a need to know and do this. And then she had a need to write about it and tell people about it.
And now a striptease from the beautiful Susan Walsh for you out there in Midnight Blue Land.
Hi, I'm Susan Walsh and I'm a dancer. This is what I do for you when I dance in gentlemen's clubs. I move as if I were your lover, some fantastic embodiment of veloxed beauty, breathless, hungry, siren.
Susan wrote this essay for Al Goldstein's Midnight Blue porn cable show. And defending the notion of free speech, they put it on.
Now, I exist for you. You say you will, you must tease my sexual nerves. You laugh when I struggle to protect my nipples from your raggedy fingers, as if I'm trying to believe the absurd notion that I'm real.
She smiles, takes off her top, calls the bar patrons pathetic droplets of insect mucus.
We count the dollar bills you stuff into our costumes or fold into nauseatingly cute shapes like frogs or flowers. We unravel it all at the end of the night, our legs coated with dust and bruises, and memories of your existence rush from our minds. If we thought about you too long, we'd go crazy. So we stuff your bills in our pockets, just like we stuff the idea that maybe we all lost out. Maybe paying the rent just isn't worth it.
Christmas time now, I'm back in New York. It's more than 5 months since anyone's heard a word from Susan. Susan's father, Floyd Merchant, drives in from New Jersey to see me. He looks like he's been crying. He says he often talked to Susan about quitting go-go.
The go-go bars were the worst place for somebody with her head on straight. Hers wasn't on straight. First of all, she's a recovering alcoholic and drug addict and is sitting on the railroad tracks, jumping off every time the train passes, and then jumping back right back on. I thought she might have cardiac arrest. I was almost sure she was going to go back to drinking and using.
Susan's health was failing. She had emphysema, an ulcer, and chronic bronchitis. And then she did start drinking and using drugs again, mixing them with the anti-anxiety drug Xanax. It was a potent cocktail, and Susan started getting more and more disconnected from reality.
She was already living in a fantasy world and a paranoid fantasy world, not a happy fantasy world. She was running to people saying, there's a contract out on me, but don't tell anybody. Then she'd run to somebody else and say, there's a contract out on me, but don't tell anybody. And this is a preliminary to a real breakdown.
She was addicted to the fantasy part of her life. A lot of the people that she associated with from the bars and stuff like that, they played the fantasy of FBI and CIA. And
now we're back in Jersey, Newark, on a windy, bitter December day. Jill and I are visiting Melissa Hines, Susan's best friend.
She had a friend that claimed that he belonged to the CIA. He was playing the role that she wanted to hear. Oh, I'm CIA. I'm going to Washington for the weekend. I'm working undercover against the mafia, you know? So it was like this big, you know, role-playing stuff that I think she lived for that fantasy and the danger that she thought she was in. You know, it was crazy.
And what did the guy turn out to be?
He turned out to be, worked for a trucking company. But a lot of the fantasy world that she lived in, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that she was once diagnosed with bipolar disorder, manic depressiveness, and she wasn't taking her medication. So, you know, she needed a lot of help.
Dozens of presents are piled up under Melissa's Christmas tree, most for her 9-month-old boy. Melissa's having a hard time talking to us. She and Susan used to celebrate Christmas together, and Susan was there when the baby was born. Melissa gets up, turns on a light, retrieves a well-worn folder. Like everyone in Susan's life, Melissa's been trying to figure out what happened.
This is stuff that I wrote down.
What is it?
It's different people that seen her. I wrote down who was calling her, who she was associating with. She was around a lot of different people. I mean, Friday, July 12th, Susan went to Town Tap in Irvington and was sick. I was at her house, and I talked to her, and I left. That was the last time I seen her, was July 12th. July 13th, Susan worked at the show place from 5:30 at night to 1:45 a.m.,
On July 16th, Susan left her house around noon. By 3:30, Melissa had a strange feeling. She hurried over to Susan's.
I rang the bell, and it looked like there was nobody there, and nobody answered, and I got a very, bad feeling, like just emptiness inside.
At first, everyone had a hunch. Susan had been murdered by a stalker. Susan had been kidnapped and sold to a motorcycle gang. Susan had been abducted by the Russian mob for sniffing around the story she and I were going to do. Susan was a streetwalker in Newark. She was a call girl in Elizabeth, a dancer in a nightclub upstate. Or she'd fallen in with a vampire cult. Or she'd checked herself into rehab. Or she enrolled in the witness protection plan. Or she'd died of a drug overdose. As time has passed, more and more of her friends, family, and co-workers have come to believe Susan Walsh is dead.
Okay, which house? Is it the one with the rolling Christmas lights?
No, I think it's this one.
Wait, let me just make it sure.
January. We look up a guy who says he thinks he knows what happened. He worked with Susan in the business.
Oh, is it the other one?
The guy says he'll talk on a couple of conditions. If we don't use his name, if we distort his voice, and if he talks just to Jill, not to me. She worked Gogo. He feels she understands the life. Plus, he clearly prefers the idea of a woman visiting him. I wait in the car.
Okay. I'm a little nervous. Some dogs barking. Oh, boy. Hey, puppy! Man, it is cold out.
The Star Police Command is waiting for my official report.
Why, you didn't wear your leather pants today?
Well, if you get a drink like alcohol, wine, gin and tonic, anything like that.
Here's what Jill reports from the interview. He lives with his invalid mother. Copies of Mentertainment, the guide to Jersey Go-Go, are scattered on the table. Nailed into the wall, there's a whip broken in half. In his spare time, the guy makes knives. He keeps a photo album, Polaroids of his go-go girls, to help him book clubs. He has 80 dancers working all over Jersey. He drives them to and from their gigs.
You're your own boss. It's your car. You can tell them to drink, smoke, or not. You know, I constantly have a girl saying, well, can I smoke in here? And they're like, yeah, no problem. But I got a little bit of the power there. I can tell them no. Suffer. Let's see you go through a nicotine fit for the next half hour. I'm sadistic.
Guess so.
During the interview, the guy won't look Jill in the eyes. He turns on the TV, puts it on mute, stares at it. He puffs on his pipe, lighting it over and over.
Let me ask you some more stuff about Susan, then.
What kind of person was she?
She is your typical average dancer. If there was rap music on, she could dance to that. If it was rock and roll, she could dance to that. It didn't matter. She was good about the whole thing. If somebody was 36 and danced, I'd say she was in pretty good shape. She wasn't, like, untoned or anything like that. She was pretty tight. The only thing she didn't have was a tan.
And what do you think happened to her?
I think she found some sort of fatal attraction who made her just that. And she got into somebody's car that she knew and drove away with him and never came back.
What makes you think that? That it was a fatal attraction thing? Had you heard about this happening?
Yeah, she had spoke to me within the prior 2 weeks to this and said how somebody was constantly beeping her. And Susan can just be so friendly, so nice, and naive. Maybe she didn't realize what kind of person this actually is.
It's not clear how much this go-go driver really knows, but Susan did tell people she had a stalker. She told me the week before she disappeared. She told Melissa. She told the therapist. And during a shoot for a documentary Jill's producing, she told a group of other dancers 2 days before she disappeared.
That's my beeper. Oh. It's probably a stalker right now. I do have a stalker.
You have a stalker?
Yeah, I have a stalker. I usually have stalkers.
It could have been Susan's paranoia talking. Most of the people who knew her well believe she died of a drug overdose, and whoever was with her panicked and disposed of the body. And the Nutley, New Jersey police say they checked out the stalker theory. They say they twice hauled in a guy and determined he had nothing to do with Susan's disappearance. But the cops themselves were slow in getting started. A week or so after Susan vanished, I called them to see what they knew. A detective told me, well, she's, you know, a dancer. She's probably out, you know, partying. Eventually, several of us pointed out Susan was also a journalist on assignment. Within days, they'd begun a major investigation.
Yeah, we wanted to see Detective Ryan. I'm Sandy Tolan. He's expecting us.
Jill and I finally got to talk to the cops in December. But before we could ask them any questions, they made a big point of showing us how much work they'd done. Hundreds of hours, 3 loose-leaf binders filled up with information on the case. We sat down at a small round table with Detectives Johnson and Ferraro. On the walls, framed posters from cop movies, Out for Justice, One Good Cop. Detective Ferraro delivers the official line, Nutley police believe Susan Walsh is still alive.
It's just that she's chosen not to come home at this time. We don't have any other reasons to feel that through all the interviews that we've taken and statements that we've taken and people that we've talked to, don't really have any concrete evidence to show that, you know, something has happened to her.
Nutley police say they've checked out many reports of people who claim they saw Susan streetwalking in Newark, dancing go-go in North Jersey or New York, but nothing checked out.
Every lead dead-ended. There was just nothing else to go on.
And so the investigation petered out. Then in February, hopes rose again as Susan made prime time.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries.
Susan Walsh was a woman who lived on the edge, a stripper-turned-journalist whose chosen assignments plunged her into a hazardous stew of Russian mobsters and self-proclaimed vampires. In the end, however, Susan Walsh's walk on the wild side may have led to her death.
It was another false hope, producing few new leads. Months before, Jim Ridgway and I had watched them film part of the docudrama. It was in Tower Books, where Jim and Susan had done a book signing for Red Light. Now, the Unsolved Mysteries crew was shooting a reenactment.
Very quiet, please. This is rehearsal.
Up on the mezzanine, there's wine, cheese, cameras, Klieg lights, and actors playing the parts of Jim and Susan. Suddenly, the director spots the real Jim.
Hey, got an imposter here. Get him out of here. Hey. What are you doing? You communist. Get over here. Get over that corner. I'm serious. Come here. I can't have you in the shot. Come here.
You stand in the corner, looking out at actors who look disturbingly like the real Jim Ridgway, tall, graying, paternal, and the real Susan Walsh, slight, blonde, vibrant.
Step back, please. Well,
we'll be light. Well,
okay, this is picture. Everyone, this is picture. Stand by. Roll sound. We're rolling.
Ten, take one, Mark.
And action.
Hello, Princess Mark. Hi. Gosh, you came out again for us. Thank you.
The fake Susan makes small talk, signing copies of Red Light while the fake Jim stands by. I point to the fake Jim's larger belly and make a face. Ridgway obliges with a sour grin, but he's looking past me, gazing at the image of a woman he worked with for 3 years, alive again for a moment.
And cut.
And cut. That's a cut. Back to one, everyone, please. Back to one. Thank you.
I've stayed in it so long that my health is so bad. I have emphysema, bronchitis, and an ulcer. Jeez. Yeah, and I was in the hospital twice in the last 2 weeks.
This is the real Susan in the documentary shoot with Jill and the other dancers. It was 2 days before she disappeared, and it was like Susan was watching herself go down.
I just went through the same thing. I'm just trying to hang on to my raison d'etre and my reason for being at this point. I'm just trying to hang on. But I stayed in so long that it got me, because you can crawl on stage half dead. But I stayed in it so long. If you stay in it so long, it will break down your health to the point where you just can't go out and get the job. Now, if I had a month to rest, get my health back, but I can't because I'm the only one supporting my son. So I can't stop. And yet, staying in it is killing me. So I'm sort of scared right now.
A Sunday morning, and I'm going back home to Boston. I drop over to say goodbye to Jill.
Susan is an extension of all the dancers, all of us. And so what happened to her is that typical dancer trap of going all the way down this downward spiral and choosing the darkest path. And she chose the darkest path that we all see. We can see that path, and yet she took it. And it's possible that I could have taken it, or that any one of these other girls could have taken it. And that's really terrifying. And especially that she's this really smart, warm, loving mother, funny, and even she went down that path. I mean, she was an incredible human being.
Coming up, another woman and a porn customer who changes in a minute when our program continues.